Welcome to our last discussion panel.
Yeah, indeed.
We like the concept of a microphone.
So yeah, hi. It seems to work. Just give it back to Philip.
So we decided that probably because many people are tired that we will not make it any longer than five, if at most. Welcome to the last discussion session. The topic should be prospects and limitations of informational approaches. So in some sense, wrapping up this conference, what have we learned, and how far can an informational approach take us in fundamental physics? And we have, again, six panelists. And we have one special guest here who wants to play the role of the devil's advocate. And so he was asking us to speak first. So.
Thanks. Well, I asked to speak first, actually, because I have both a pleasant and an unpleasant duty. The unpleasant duty you see behind me. But the pleasant duty is that we've thanked so far the person who organized the organizers of the conference, but we haven't yet thanked the actual organizers, Philip, Shard, and Marcus. Anyone who's organized anything like this knows how much work it is and how much can go wrong. And so I think we have, since none of that happened, we have to, and everything went right, I think we have to thank them as well.
That sounded more like an angel.
That was, yeah. That was just to fool you. Wasn't the devil a fallen angel or something like that? So I'm now on my way down.
Okay.
So, as you can see, I've been asked to play devil's advocate, and I will try to oblige by being provocative. However, for clarity and also for brevity, I will state things more dogmatically than I would have done if I had a longer presentation. In addition to that caveat, I want to make a couple of others. First of all, it goes without saying, or maybe it goes with saying, since I'm now saying it, that I'm not criticizing any specific work presented this week. Everyone obviously should work on whatever they find most interesting. And beyond that, a lot of the work that was presented is actually quite compatible with the kind of prejudice and things that I'm going to be advocating. The second caveat is that although quantum foundations is intrinsically important and interesting, obviously, otherwise we wouldn't be here, my own interest in it is very strongly colored, by my activity in quantum gravity. I want to know what can quantum foundations do for quantum gravity. So with that background, I have sort of four bugaboos, pet peeves, prejudices, bias, hobby horses, pick your favorite word, about some of the ways in which quantum foundations is practiced now. I started to list them there. The first one, I'll just read through the list, and then I'll try to say a little bit about each one of them. The first one, by the way, can people hear all right? I can't tell if it, I don't have to try to speak loudly. Okay. The first one is operationalism. The second one is treating information as more fundamental than its material basis in the physical world. The third is undue neglect of relativistic quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, and of course quantum gravity in thinking about foundations. And the fourth is undue neglect of what I would call space-time formulations of quantum mechanics. In other words, histories formulations and specifically path integral formulations. So I'll try to say a little bit about each one of them as time permits. So the first, operationalism. So at appropriate moments in history, obviously, operational considerations can play a critical role. But to my mind, I do not think they can be creative or produce new concepts. The classic example, of course, is the analysis of absolute time in relation to special relativity and the operational analysis of how clocks are synchronized. In that case, data had accumulated that was not compatible with the existing framework, because people were making wrong assumptions, which had to be recognized and abandoned. We're not so lucky today with quantum gravity. There's a paucity of data, and what's needed is precisely new concepts, new hypotheses of a material nature, if you like, models, examples would be strings or causal sets. This I don't think operational thinking can provide. There's another problem, which is that the expected domain of application of quantum gravity is about as remote from a laboratory setting as you could possibly get. The very early universe, the vacuum at Planck scales, black hole singularities, et cetera. If we're lucky, astronomical observations, but not experiment in the laboratory sense, I think, is going to be our best empirical input for some time to come. If quantum foundations is going to help guide quantum gravity, therefore, it needs to get away from the operational paradigm. There were no laboratories or external agents or observers in the early universe, but there was something. If quantum foundations can answer the question, what that was, what is the reality to which the quantum formalism refers, I think that cannot help but be relevant to the rest of physics. That was so much for operationalism. Okay, now I'll try to speed up and just briefly touch on the other point. For many of the reasons that I've just stated, it seems unlikely that the concept of information will lead us any closer to quantum gravity. Information is an abstraction that is useful when one wants to build a quantum computer or even if one wants to build a steam engine. But there's always a physical basis to it, and that's what I think we need to aim at. To the extent that quantum mechanics is just about information, it's not concrete. But concreteness is what we want. It's more important to elucidate the structure of quantum dynamics insofar as it concerns reality directly and not insofar as it concerns just our information about reality. To summarize, the slogan bit from it is correct. The slogan it from bit has things backwards. On the other two points, which are closely connected, even more closely connected, neglect of relativistic quantum theories. Quantum foundations is hard. Non-relativistic quantum mechanics is easier than quantum foundations, which in turn is easier than quantum field theory in perturbed space-time, which of course is easier than quantum gravity. So let's solve the simple problems first before tackling the harder ones. This is the thinking that I believe is behind the primary focus on non-relativistic quantum mechanics in a lot of quantum foundations work. If you're interested in being of service to quantum gravity, it's clearly not a very good strategy. But even from the point of view of quantum foundations itself, it might also be a bad strategy. If you pay more attention to relativistic quantum mechanics, and maybe even quantum gravity, it might influence quantum foundations per se. Without this input, it might actually be harder to solve some of the problems that one is looking at than with the input. Here I'm thinking specifically about history's formulations, but that's really my fourth point. So let me just say, from the point of view of quantum foundations more narrowly, not to do with quantum gravity, that I think there's a bunch of interesting foundational problems that are just begging to be answered that are not getting addressed. I could say more about them later, but one of them is the Bohr-Rosenfeld analysis of measurability. That was only done, I don't know how many people are familiar with that, but it was only done semi-classically, and as far as I can see, it breaks down totally when you come to non-abelian gauge theories, non-linear theories. So one could ask, can it be done fully quantum mechanically, first of all, and second of all, can it be extended to non-linear theories? Another example is measurement theory for relativistic quantum field theory. It doesn't exist. Do we need such a theory, and can one be devised? And another question, dear to my heart, which has come up a lot this week, is what do we mean by relativistic causality? The answer to that is bound to be relevant to quantum gravity, too. Then the final thing is on the what I call the undue neglect, not the total neglect, of course, of space-time formulations. If you look at the work of a practicing quantum field theory, you're much more likely to see a path integral than you are to see a wave function in the Schrodinger picture. Yet this doesn't seem to be reflected in the work of quantum foundations. There's some work on history's approaches, but it doesn't get that much attention. But the only really covariant formulations of quantum theories, or I think even of classical theories, are histories formulations, or what you might call space-time formulations, unless we're going to return to pre-relativistic space-time, as some people seem to think we might do. I think it behooves us to seek a formulation of quantum theory which is covariant from beginning to end, and the only way I know to do that is through a histories-based formulation.
Am I next in line? Okay. Well, I will start with an optimistic note, which is, what else could we be talking about in understanding physics than about information? All our books about physics contain information, our theories of particles or materials or whatever in physics is about information. So you could, of course, put information central. That's rather something of a tautology. I think in the case of quantum gravity, the very deep and very mysterious problem is how nature is processing information. What's nature's bookkeeping system? We don't understand how it works at the Planck scale. Black holes are very strongly giving us the impression that information is somehow spread over a surface, something like the black hole horizon. But what if there happens to be no black hole inside that surface? Is that still, does that surface still contain the information of the inside world? We all believe so, that the black hole is contains a maximum amount of information that you can have anywhere, because it's the most generic state you can get. When you have a certain amount of entropy on a surface. So the black hole horizon is everything about information. But we've also heard, particularly in this last talk today, that when you try to axiomatize things, that you might miss out on very important pieces of information of how to make a model of nature. I think when people worked out axiomatic field theory, they did not really discover the importance of non-Hermitian gauge invariance. Whereas now we know that's a central thing if you want to understand elementary particles in the standard model. Without non-Hermitian gauge invariance, these theories simply don't work. But that had to be found out by people who were making models and who were looking at the experiments. So you still can't avoid having to look at experimental data when you do physics. You always have to remember that. So now when it comes to information, you also all realize how difficult the notion of information really is. For instance, a question I am frequently looking at without finding a satisfactory answer is, how much information is there in the vacuum state? Imagine if you've pulled all the particles out of the world and you have left over the vacuum, how much information is there left? You could say nothing. Vacuum means empty by definition. So if you've pulled everything out, there simply is no information in the vacuum. Yet, in all our quantum theories, in particular quantum field theory, we also know there's such a thing as vacuum fluctuations. Fields and particles are created and annihilated, they fluctuate, they do something extremely complicated. And also, when we learn about Hawking radiation, we see that a region of space-time, which originally was a vacuum region, suddenly is perceived by an outside observer as sprouting particles, lots of them, which each of which contains a tremendous amount of information. So how do we deal with the notion of information in the case of a black hole horizon and in the case of treating the vacuum? That's a big problem. So for instance, the black hole horizon, when we consider the problem of entanglement, we hit upon the problem of the so-called firewall. That is the question, does an observer who goes into a horizon actually go through without unharmed, or is he being killed by a firewall? And now I'm strongly suspecting that this is a question of a transformation of one piece of information to another piece of information. But a firewall contains loads and loads of particles, like you're killed because you're being shot at, like with a machine gun. And every single bullet contains lots of information. Whereas if you're in vacuum, you're you are in a familiar spot of space and time and nothing happens to you. So how do we handle this situation? That's a big problem that none of us has been able to fully understand still today. Another problem that has come up very frequently in this meeting in particular is how do we consider information? Are we consider quantum information, qubits, or classical information, C-bits you could call them? What is the proper way to handle information? I think here we have to think very hard about how to make models. And I've been advocating in my talk that classical bits should, in principle, be sufficient to do the jobs. In the meantime, of course, we realize from daily life in a quantum world that we are in practice handling qubits and find that more convenient. Maybe there's a mathematical way of going from one picture to the other picture. It's something that still has to be sorted out. There are still very mysteries at that point. Well, to start with, to end up with the same optimism as I started with, I just want to make a remark. I have this very deep observation that history always turns out to repeat itself. The only thing about that is it never repeats itself in a predictable manner.
Thank you. Or maybe I'll just hold it. Let me see. Prospects and limitations of information. Let me start by saying that I'm also extremely optimistic about the prospects of having an information theoretical approach to physics, except that I'm extremely optimistic for a completely opposite reason. The way I see this, we can have an attitude of trying to read the mind of God when we produce models to describe the universe and go for straight ultimate reality. Or we can more honestly recognize that we are just a bunch of post-Neanderthal neurons who are trying to come up with models for how to navigate the world. And our models are more or less like those maps for the subway stations, where you have red lines that tells you if you go from here to there, you get what you want. But of course, the red line doesn't correspond to anything in reality. It's just a useful tool to navigate the world. I really think that our physics models are very much like that. And some of the features in our physics models supposedly represent something real out there, maybe not. And some of the tools, like probabilities, are just the tools that we Neanderthals, or post, some of us have Neanderthal genes. So these are the tools that we have designed for the purpose of navigating and coping with the world. And so it's a little bit more disconnected to reality. Concerning the design of these inference tools, we need to design tools that allow us to codify our uncertainties in a way that's free from inconsistencies. That's a problem that has been solved. It's called probability theory. We also need to have reliable tools for processing information in the sense of updating when we receive information. And those are, I believe, are fairly well understood by now. We know how to use Bayes' theorem. We know how to use entropies. We are in pretty decent shape. What we're not at all in very good shape at this point is when we're processing information to learn something about our system, it's not always clear how we decide what that information ought to be. How do you figure out what the right questions to ask are? We need a good theory of questions. We also need to have a good theory of measures of relevance. What is the question that ends up being most relevant to a particular interest or purpose? So those are aspects that still need to be developed. But I have no reason to believe that we won't make progress in that direction as well. So that's concerning my optimism for saying that indeed, if it's not going to be informational approaches, what else could it be? It's another way to say the same thing. Maybe there is a theory out there that really goes for the guts of the universe. Maybe there is. Maybe it exists. Strings or other theories. Yes, maybe those exist. And if those theories can be constructed, we're in good shape.
But then, maybe those theories do not exist. So if those theories do not exist, then I'm right. We should just go for processing information. But suppose those theories, those fundamental theories, can be found. It's still legitimate to say, what is the best inference I can make on the basis of the limited information I have? So those models, those maps of the subway stations that allow us to navigate this world in an efficient and useful way, those would still be valuable. So there is a very deep sense in which I think that if I'm right, I'm right. And if I'm wrong, then I'm also right. Okay? So it's incredibly safe to proceed this way. Finally, limitations. Well, I did mention a couple of limitations here. We do need a theory of relevance, a theory of what questions to ask next. That's, so far, that's typically done by trial and error. I fully agree with Raphael's and Gerard's remarks that our studies of foundations should include the fact that you can't ignore the standard model, you can't ignore gauge theories, you can't ignore space and time. They can't be ignored. To quote Faraday, when someone asked him, what's the use of induction? What's the use of a newborn baby? Right? They say, well, someday, sir, you will tax it, right? I would like to quote Julio, who has a much better one. He says, Julio said today at lunch, he said, I have produced this beautiful string quartet, and you ask me, where are the drums? You can't do everything all at once. So give me time, and we'll do Jan-Jules theories too. But it's crucial. I agree. Without that, we have nothing. Anything else? Well, I'm optimistic. We'll do it. It's within our lifetimes.
I have to leave soon. Okay, I found what Raphael said very compelling, but there is an aspect that, so respect to the second point, putting first information versus the substrate, if you think in terms of models and in terms of the physics and forget information, then there is something that for me remains to be explained, which is that I work in general probabilistic theories, and I've been exploring lots of things that look very different from quantum theory and classical probability theory. And in a generic probability theory, there is no notion of information, in the sense that you could not talk about dynamics or about measurements or about states without specifying the substrate. This is what happens generically in general probabilistic theories. Okay, so we could not write Shor's algorithm abstractly without specifying the substrate. So quantum theory has this sort of symmetry, okay? That, of course, if you have an informational approach, it comes for free. But if not, I don't know how it could be explained. That's all.
If there's any comments that the audience wants to make, in fact, we wanted to involve pretty much everyone.
Question to Louis, actually. Can you be more specific? What does it mean that you are unable to specify what is information without specifying the substrate?
Yeah, exactly. We are so used to it because classical probability theory is also the same. I mean, digital information can be put to any system, but if you have a theory where you have a state space of this shape, this complex set, and one of this shape, okay, there is not a reversible transformation that can put these states here. Okay, you naively can think of this transformation, okay, but this cannot be reversible because the inverse, what would do with this state? Okay, it would go with that negative probabilities. Okay, this is just a simple example of what happens generically.
Okay, well, as far as the future of information theoretic approaches is concerned, I have to admit that after spending a week at this meeting, I'm no longer sure what information means.
That's progress.
Well, I mean, so it seems to me that we call what we're doing information for various reasons. One of the reasons is that, say, 50% of the people working on these approaches used to work on quantum information theory, so they're used to calling what we do information. But it certainly has little to do with information theory in the traditional sense. So what I would like to pin down is exactly what is the common feature of the kinds of approaches that we've been hearing about. So the best idea I can come up with is that is the following slogan. So understanding physics means understanding structure, and in particular understanding the common structures that connect different approaches. So for example, we have in Lucian's approach this strong axiom that says that the mathematical formalism must reflect the structure of how things are composed operationally in the model. And we have in the resource theory's approach the idea that the important things are the common structures that exist between various different resource theories, the idea of free operations and this kind of thing. So what we seem to be meaning when we say information theoretic approaches to quantum theory is the thought that understanding structures, understanding perhaps what Dorian calls formal analogies, is what it means to understand a theory. So my minor suggestion is that perhaps in the future of this particular area will be that we won't call our next conferences information theoretic approaches to the foundations of physics, but maybe structuralist approaches to the foundations of physics. So that's one idea for how the future of this kind of subject is going to go. But before I conclude, I want to at least contest, since we're supposed to be having a discussion, I want to contest at least one of the points that has been made, which is this idea that somehow what we're doing in operational approaches is to do with non-relativistic quantum theory. I don't know about you, but I didn't see anybody write p squared over 2m on the blackboard. It's true that a lot of approaches have to do with finite dimensional systems, and there are some people who are sort of philosophically committed to finite dimensionalism, but I don't think that applies to most people. We could equally well put arbitrary Banach spaces on the wires of circuits rather than the finite dimensional vector spaces. And so it seems to me that whole idea of this approach is that we're studying the structure that's common to all of these things, right? So yes, quantum field theory is a very different theory from non-relativistic quantum mechanics, but it still has Hilbert spaces or operator algebras or whatever. And the thought is that the context of quantum theory, or the meaning of quantum theory, is that this structure in itself, thought of as a generalized probability theory, is the content of what it means to be a quantum theory. So if that's true, you're not going to get any more particular insights about the nature of quantum theory by sticking a Lorentz invariant field theory down instead of just studying the abstract structure of quantum theory. Now, of course, we do ultimately want to apply these results to relativistic quantum mechanics, but I think the thought is that you're not going to get any further insight into what quantum theory means from the activity of doing that. So that's just my comment on that. Pass it to Robert.
Thanks. Very fitting, because let me start by strongly disagreeing with you. So, I was planning to start by replying to Raphael, but now that's a good opportunity for this. So I think there's much more difference between, doing quantum theory with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces or infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, I agree. This is not going to make the difference, and this is not going to provide principal new insights. But there's another aspect that's central in a non-relativistic world, which is this fixed notion of time that I also mentioned at the beginning of my talk. And that's very strongly ingrained in the standard formulation of quantum theory, and this kind of notion of that measurements are things that happen sequentially and that have to happen sequentially to make sense so that you can have meaningful probabilities and so on. I think that a more fundamental, as I would like to call it, version of quantum theory, or let's put it a different way, a version of quantum theory that could accommodate quantum gravity cannot have this notion of fixed temporal sequentiality as at its basis. So in that sense, I do think that we do learn more about the foundations of quantum theory by taking into account relativistic, special relativistic, or even general relativistic physical settings. So there I have to strongly agree with Raphael on that point, and that's kind of my justification for this. So now let's go to the other point. So let me now try to reply a little bit to what Raphael said. So in some points I'm very much in agreement with him, in others not. Let me start with operationalism and make another defense of operationalism, in addition to the ones we heard from Ariel and others. I tried to mention this already a little bit at the beginning of my talk. One thing we have learned when we transition from a classical worldview to a quantum worldview is that the observer, or the fact that you do a measurement, changes the world, and in a sense, and that you cannot think of the world as something given to you absolutely and in the sense of fields and particles living in space-time and laid out once and for all. I think that is a very strong reason to think operationalist and to be cautious and say, when I want to describe the world, what I should really do is I should describe it through the way I interact with the world. So, and there's the operationalism. And in a quantum theory, the starting point for that is the, in my opinion, the measurement process. So it's very natural to start with that and to think of that in an operationalist way. And that's especially necessary when you're in a setting like, suppose you want to do quantum gravity, where, coming back to this point of the sequential temporal structure that you usually use, where you do not have that. So you have to be extra cautious and should even less try to assume something about the world as a whole that you really don't know anything about. Another direction that justifies this operationalist perspective came through, I think, very well in Lucien's talk, namely when you're in general relativity. And I mean, you all know that there are severe problems with talking about observers in general relativity. So, I mean, you know that there are severe problems with observables in general relativity, and there's also a problem of locality and gauge transformations. I mean, if you're somewhere in space-time, and suppose you have a slightly different space-time, whatever that means, in the sense of a slightly different metric, now how do you compare that? I mean, slightly different in a physical sense. I mean, it could, in addition to making a small perturbation, could be gauge transformed by diffeomorphisms and look completely different. So, and that has to do with the fact that you're looking at global solutions. So you need a kind of more local notion of looking at the world. And in Lucien's talk, that came through using this WS space. And I think that's a very promising approach there. So that's a second justification for operationalism. Now, the next point was information. And here I don't have too much to say, except that I think that information, in a sense, is I agree that it's something that always should be tied to some concrete physical meaning of it in a physical theory. One thing that it can help us perhaps to do is to distinguish in a physical theory or let's say in a mathematical framework of a physical theory, the parts that are more essential from the ones that are perhaps not so essential. So the ones that are essential are usually the ones that are in a direct sense related to the information that we have or extract from a physical system. And so from this point of view, that could be seen as a device for the theorist to try to, on the one hand, generalize, on the other hand, better understand given theoretical frameworks. So what was the next point that Raphael was talking about? Yeah, okay, so I already talked about this, I agree very strongly with him there. And he was also talking about the path integral, and well, as you've seen in my talk, the path integral appeared there, and in fact, it appeared there, moreover, in connection with this notion of composition, which also has come up a lot. So I do think that the path integral, at least seen as a theoretical device, is fruitful, but maybe in contrast to Raphael, I'm not sure what his opinion would be. I think that it connects very well with an operationalist point of view. So let me.
So just to inform you that Louis and David had to leave because they're traveling now. So they weren't so appalled by the discussion. But, I don't know if anyone from the audience wants to say something about Chasla.
Can I talk just like that?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to go back. I mean, I actually agree with almost everything what Robert said. And so operationalism is always associated to agents' actions in the laboratory, what an observer can do or can't do in the laboratory. And I do think that there is a justified objection towards, like, what can we say about space or time when there were no observers, and what we mean when we talk about the state of the universe, early state of the universe. But if you're not radical in this operationalism, then of course you will not require the presence of an agent in front of the process you want to describe, and at least in my opinion, I understood operationalism in a very weak sense, and in the sense that we shouldn't leave the scientific endeavor in a sense that we make hypotheses and then test them either directly or indirectly. And so even if we talk about the temperature of the early universe, I hope we speak in a sense of an imaginary observer who can be in front of that and make sense of this concept of the temperature by some operational procedure. Because I don't know what it would mean then to talk about temperature. And it might not be an imaginary observer at the moment when this happens. It could be maybe a current observer that looks at the universe and can probably infer what the temperature was at that time. If we really don't do that, then we are on the slippery ground to talk even about concepts. And at the end, how would we prove that the string theory is true or not? Even if it's true. And I think there is very often misunderstanding of operationalism in a very radical sense of physical presence of the agent.
Okay, Matt is going to follow up on this, and then Rob.
So I don't disagree with what Czeslaw said mostly. I think I just wanted to add a point that Lucy in a way emphasizes, which is that there's a big distinction between operational ism, we like these ism words, and operational methodology. And all that one is really being committed to in any of these approaches is the idea that, you know, at our present state of understanding of quantum theory, it's really unclear how we should describe reality, and it's much more reliable to base things on observable quantities. Now I'm going to tell the awful joke that I always make sure I have to tell all the time, which is that the history of quantum foundations has a real problem. It's called the problem of quantum jumps, which is that physicists in the past have always jumped to conclusions about quantum theory. So what operationalism is supposed to be, the operational methodology is supposed to be a guard against doing that. It's a guard against making sort of radical hypotheses, this is what reality must be like, which have so often been shown to be wrong in the past.
Expressed half of what I wanted to say. But let me add something to that, that it, even when one grants operationalism as a methodological approach with, you know, the goal of a dynamical explanation down the road, the operational approach can also constrain the dynamical approach in the following sense. So this example of the early universe, the way I like to put it is this. If I work out, say, a resource theory of thermodynamics, which involves agents and engineers, and what the theory tells me is, even if you could control the unitary which acts on all the microscopic particles to whatever degree of precision you'd like, you would nonetheless face X, Y, and Z constraints. That has consequences for the dynamics of the early universe, because if an engineer can't do it with arbitrarily great resources, then nature can't do it naturally either. So I think it's useful to think of the engineer paradigm as, you know, an engineer is like a part of nature, and anything an engineer can't do can't just happen either. So I think that's often forgotten, that there are lessons of the operational approach for dynamical approaches as well.
It's too bad that Luis had to leave, because I did want to say, and I think in the introduction I said that I'm presenting things more dogmatically than I would if there was more time. And I would be the last person to say that information is not important, right? Information, to my mind, is a descendant, conceptual descendant of entropy. And entropy is obviously very important. We learned a lot from the study of entropy. Thermodynamics was historically important. It led in part to statistical mechanics, but I do think that the statistical mechanic basis of thermodynamics was a big advance. We found the material basis or substratum of this information, or in the form of heat. And we're, to some extent, in the same situation today in quantum gravity. We seem to have an understanding of the thermodynamics of black holes, and we lack the statistical mechanical explanation of it. And this is obviously, or I think many of us feel, it's an important clue to what quantum gravity is like. So I wouldn't deny that for a moment. Now, as far as operationalism, if it means no more that we should be careful to make sure that we can test our theories, then I can't see how anyone could possibly object to it. But I think there's a lot more to it than that, which it would be unfair to suppress, right? I mean, I think it really, if we wanted to use a philosophical language, I would say that operationalism tends to be a form of idealism, and what we need is a materialist approach to physics. In other words, it's more about us than it is about nature. Now, it's true, I mean, I want to say two things to soften that statement. First of all, I think it's true that quantum mechanics has taught us something important about how we are part of the universe. This was the point that Bohr was always making in his own cryptic way. We can't think about the universe as if it was something completely separate from us, and we're godlike outside just watching it. That's true. I'm not sure that in my own thinking I've completely taken that into consideration, and I'm not sure that our theoretical understanding in general has completely taken that into consideration. But to say that we have to conceive of everything as if there was an observer sitting there, and how would the observer understand it? That just doesn't seem, I just don't see how anyone can say that. If you go back 100 years or 150 or whatever it is, we cannot say people were not doing real physics. But they were not always talking about observers and how and this and this and this and this. They were dealing directly with the physical system that was of interest. I mean, of course, it's always good to as a kind of what's the word you use? I mean, to prevent yourself from running off in completely crazy directions, it's always good to be keeping track of how could I observe this? What effect would it have? But if you look at something like the CMB, which is one of the central topics of study in cosmology, of course, if you think of it just as a organizing information, I don't think you'll never get anywhere. I mean, there's a lot of information there. You can organize it. This is what we call phenomenology. And phenomenology is an absolutely crucial part of physics, and it's a stage in the development of physical theories. But to understand the fluctuation in CMB, you need a model of the Euler universe. I just don't see any way to get around that, and I don't see how thinking about circuits in laboratories is going to lead it to you. Okay, so that's more on the dogmatic side. On the more less dogmatic side, I would say, yes, circuits are important, so on. It may be that when you think about them, it leads you to certain kinds of concepts, and one can carry those concepts over to produce models. In fact, I would say that's probably what Lucien is aiming to do. And to the extent you can do that, yes, it provided a nice inspiration. But I'm personally convinced, I'm not convinced by what anyone has said, that operationalism is more of a path to physical reality than I was before.
Well, I think I would like to say a couple of things about operationalism that I didn't touch on before. One is positive, and the other one slightly less so. The positive one is that when we're doing science, we typically don't know what we're doing. Use whatever tools you have at your disposal, no holds barred. And if imposing axioms on your thinking process will at least help you identify inconsistencies, do it. If thinking in terms of operations to tackle quantities that might actually be meaningful, do it. In the end, the only thing that justifies what we do is success. And whoever wins, won. That's it. That's the only thing that's going to say. Extremely pragmatic. Now, on the negative side, one must be careful that to recognize that just because we can measure something does not mean that there is something there being measured. Take, for example, defining temperature as something that you measure with a thermometer, which is really reasonable. That's what we do all the time. People tend to forget how difficult it was originally to come up with a notion of temperature. The original standards for temperature were the wine cellars of one particular French nobleman who had a very nice temperature to keep his wines there. That's the kind of thing that, I mean, there is a history to these things. And even today, when we measure temperature, are we measuring temperature? Or are we forgetting that really what we measure is the length of a column of mercury, for example, or the resistance of some resistor? And in the end, there is also the calibrating device that translates that quantity that presumably we measure, the length, into a temperature. Or if you want it better, you might have sampled from a particular gas or something and found out a few energy levels, and then you do a Bayesian inference to figure out what the temperature must have been so that you recover that population. So we tend to forget that whenever we measure a quantity, what's actually happening in the lab, most of the time, has nothing to do with that quantity. There is an incredible amount of inference going on in there. So we may be measuring a property of a probability distribution, which is the least physical thing that there is out there.
So one has to be very careful with operationalism while fully recognizing that even in quantum mechanics, Heisenberg, for example, started with an approach that was extremely operational for the time, and that was very successful. So we may be going through an analogous time today where operationalism is being particularly useful for a particular community, but it may not, in the end, solve everybody's problems. So.
No,
not the temperature one. Just because you have a thermometer.
This abstract concept, which we don't know what it is, into observable quantities. That's the way how we can understand them, the notion, why we introduce it in the first time.
I don't think so. Please notice, I said that operationalism can be extremely useful, yes. But there is certain types of further insights that cannot be provided by operationalism, for which you actually need models and a deeper understanding of all the inference processes that are involved in that picture. So, for example, it is perfectly okay to use thermometers in a very, very creative way, and it's extremely useful, and most engineers do not really understand very deeply what temperature is. And yet, I'm sorry, I didn't want to say that about engineers. Medical doctors, there. Medical doctors are completely aware of all the implications of having a temperature above 37 degrees Celsius, right? But I would very, very much doubt that most of them have the slightest idea of what temperature is. I think that it behooves us as physicists to also seek a deeper understanding that might not be given by purely operational methods.
I have just one or perhaps two remarks about that. One is the habit in our field to introduce the concept of an observer and a measurement, whereas precisely that has become problematic in a subject such as quantum gravity. How can you introduce an observer in quantum gravity at all? If the guy is too large and too heavy, then that observer will generate a gravitational field and disturb the thing he wants to observe. If he's too small and too light, he will show quantum fluctuations, and again, his memory is too small to remember what he has been measuring. So in all these cases, you can't really introduce an observer and a procedure to measure something. So then the question is, how do you define such notions? And that's become now very problematic. You have to reconsider whatever you define in a model. And so I would advocate the introduction of models where you have certain properties of a variable, and you can give that a name, you can take many variables and together define something that you call temperature or anything else, but you have to beware of the limitations of such a notion. I want to say something similar about probability. In my talk yesterday, I indicated that I thought that probability is not such a sacred notion anymore in quantum mechanics, but can be very, very brutally ascribed to the fact that we physicists, when we measure a system, we sometimes don't know the initial state. So our ignorance about something comes about because we didn't know what we were looking at, what the initial state was. Therefore, we were forced to introduce a notion of probability. Whereas the ultimate theory of nature, to my mind, and here I side with Einstein's old idea that there shouldn't be the notion of probability in the laws of nature. So I would advocate to Pluto the notion of probability. You know, the National Astronomical Union has decided that Pluto is a dwarf planet instead of a planet. So the word to Pluto has become a word in the English dictionary. So now the question is, my proposal is to Pluto the concept of probability and also to Pluto the concept of an observer, of a measurement. Of course, the question then will be, what do you put in place of that? That's, again, making our life hard.
One minor thing to say, I mean, when I occasionally look at talks online, you know, from string theorists, thinking about black holes and so forth, I mean, there's observers all over the place. They're jumping into the hole and
They're getting destroyed by the firewall. They're waiting until the thing evaporates and then looking at some stuff and doing some correlation. So I think, you know, maybe it is a concept that has some relevance to quantum gravity. I mean, if I, you know, I might...
Difficult to really
do these things.
Talk about things without the notion of observer, but we should make attempts or to realize that the notion of observer is not always the best thing to work with.
I agree. It may be that another approach to these problems is...
It's also true that this bias in favor of observers is not limited to people doing quantum information. it's also present in quantum gravity. It's present if you get even someone, a hardcore quantum field theorist, if you ask them to talk about the philosophy of physics, they might say something very like that, although it's not reflected in their practice. So in the case of quantum gravity, one is dealing with deep conceptual issues with very little experimental input. And I think that bias shows up. And I could quote you an extreme case of it. There was a talk here by Lenny Susskind a while ago, in which he said, I mean, I wouldn't even try to reproduce the whole train of thought, but the punchline was that we must ultimately make a transition. By the way, Lenny Susskind, I think, is one of the people with the deepest understanding of physics I know in many ways. But he said that there must be a final Minkowski-like region of space-time at the very end of the considered phase of this eternal inflation. And because if it weren't true, we would not be able to measure probabilities to the arbitrarily high precision. And since probabilities in the theory, it must be that we can measure them to an arbitrarily high precision. So this would be my prototype or my archetype, that kind of observer-based thinking. But to some extent, its prevalence in quantum gravity could be to the detriment of quantum gravity.
I mean, but still, it doesn't, you know, seem totally unreasonable to me to think that you could imagine observations being made, and then some of these are on too large of a scale.
Of course, it's very interesting. It's important to try to think what would an observer find if they found it so black hole. And, I mean, I'm not joking.
If that hole is too small, no observer fits in it, and so there's a limit to the notion of observer that you can use.
But you might try to create it in your giant accelerator, and then, you know, shoot stuff at it, and after it evaporates, see what the quantum gravity wiggles did to the stuff.
You know.
Oh yes. So I don't want to enter in the debate of operationalism and information. I think we are discussing already this in depth. I just would like to raise a little bit of a second order concern about this type of debate that we're having now. Is that in most of the debates that I, the discussion that I had when presenting the axiomatic results since 2010 to now, so it's like a sample of 5 years, I rarely had the factual discussions about the content of the axioms, but most of the discussion stopped at the level of whether or not operational information was good as a future direction for physics. We never got to the point of saying whether or not an axiom is nice or useful for to do something. And so coming back somehow to Matt's point that there are, I'm not sure if I would identify the operational slash informational approach with the structure, but definitely there are structures one can talk about. And I think there are sometimes some true things that are in papers that may transcend the labels, what is written in the title or in the abstract of those papers. And I would kind of express the concern that the type of debate that we're having now may risk to obscure the factual things that are actual results. So speaking, for instance, of operationalism, I used to call our framework operational probabilistic theories, although I have all sorts of doubts that one could possibly have about both probability and about the label operationalism. It's just that at the moment I couldn't find a better label, I couldn't find a better conceptual systematization of things to change the title. And first of all, it's also good to keep the same name for the same thing until you have really made up your mind. So I think sometimes it may be good to go a little bit further than the name, the title that is in the paper or what is in the abstract. What are the actual products that these things have raised? And in this thing, I would put these results as a kind of serious discipline by itself, in the same way as there are other disciplines in physics. So there is a notion of being a professional of general probabilistic theory, as much as there is a notion of being a professional of quantum field theory or classical mechanics. So not everybody is doing, of course, the same thing. And physics is a free field, so everybody is able to say something about the other things. But there is such a thing as gaining expertise about something. And at some point, I think it would be, not now, of course, but at some point it would be good to have also factual discussions about the contents of what has been done.
I think Rob wants to follow up on this.
Yeah. So first, I wanted to respond to something Raphael said earlier. I think your quote was something like, I don't think that we have to constrain ourselves to operational concepts. I mean, that seems to fail to acknowledge what Matt says, that nobody's saying that we constrain ourselves to operational concepts. So we're not talking that, you know, the only subject matter of physics is operations. It's rather a methodological principle that can be useful is to think about, you know, what's empirically accessible. So I think it would be more healthy to have the debate of, you know, do we have too little or too much, and how's the balance between these two things? Because I think we all agree that they're both worthwhile. So I want to suggest that, contrary to what you and Gerard seem to think, that we have too little operationalism in physics, that we need more operationalism. And so just as one example, I would cite a great triumph of operationalism from modern physics, Bell's theorem. So I think, you know, the history of quantum foundations for a long time was about model construction and trying to tell stories that were consistent with the quantum formalism. And I think when things really started to progress more rapidly was when Bell decided to ask questions about all possible models. So he saw this feature of Bohmian mechanics and he said, I wonder if I can prove a theorem just about, you know, the kinds of statistics we see in the lab and whether all attempts at model construction that have this property that we explained it by a common cause might fail to do so. And to my mind, that really heavily trumps the project of building one model after another in an attempt to try to understand something. I mean, it's a statement about all models that you might construct. So anyhow, I think that's just one nice example of how operationalism has done great things for the field of quantum foundations.
I couldn't agree with you more about the importance of Bell's theorem in guiding developments in quantum foundations. But where I don't agree is I don't see what it has to do with operationalism. It has to do with experiment. If you want to say, I mean, that's what I mean, there's a sort of easy slide from saying we have to make contact with experiment and observation to say we have to be operationalist. I think we should resist that slide. I mean, what Bell did was consider, just as you said, a large class of models. He found a common feature. He thought about the meaning of relativistic causality deeply. He introduced a notion of local causality, which a model can or cannot, you know, some models will satisfy and some will not. And he brought out what the implications of this local causality were. I don't see what about that is operational. What it is
everything about it's operational. It's thinking about framework of model construction. I think a model constructor would say, I need to have a picture of what a spin is. It might be a string, it might be something else. And now let me model my devices in terms of their particles. And Bell focused on outcomes, settings, and made claims about all models. I think it's the furthest thing from the model construction paradigm that you're describing.
No, but, well, we have to disagree.
Of course, he deliberately didn't mention Lander in this. Although I agree with what you're saying about Bell's theory, most people regard it as a theorem about realist models.
I agree it is.
Yeah, and
it agrees.
If you're a pure operationalist, suppose you're not just that, right? How do you even formulate what Bell means by this thing? It just doesn't seem to be in the language. So, I mean, it seems like this theorem occupies a middle ground between thinking about observable things and trying to construct models of reality. It's not model construction, but neither is it complete operation.
But I don't propose it as a defense of the ism, the person who says it's all operations. I'm proposing it as the importance of not neglecting the operational methodology. And I'm saying if we had neglected that operational methodology, we might not have Bell's theorem today. We might have
I mean, for what it's worth, does anyone, like a historian or someone, know whether Bell himself tended towards operationalism or against? My suspicion, strong suspicion, would that be he would not tend toward it.
You mean the ism to the exclusion of all else, or the methodology that is useful to...
I don't know.
Why is it relevant what Bell thought?
Well, because he's the one who probably, among others, thought deepest about the implications and the background of his theorem, his inequality. But I don't want to push it. I just raised the question.
Just
look. Yeah, but, I mean... I don't want whether this is operationalism or it's really irrelevant, but I mean, so I think really this is the decisive point in finding out what the meaning of the Bell's theorem is. Once you start to think about conditional probabilities, about decoupling the whole experiment or into two variables, one which you can control and one which you can't control. The first is the setting, and the second is the outcome. And only through combination of these different choices of this what you can control, you can come up with an idea to pose, which you can answer through the Bell's theorem. Otherwise, you can just, and that's how I understand also Professor Wolf's attempt, is that you have a joint probability for the whole thing. And you can't even pose then the question and may have a no-go theorem. And for me, this is really a big step into distinguishing parts of the world that we can control or not, and part we can't control, where we ask questions and get answers.
Okay, Tobias.
Let me just object to that. So I think the notion of control in Bell's theorem is a little bit of red herring in the sense that it's only about independence, whether there is an actual agent there, yeah, choosing settings, or whether it's a quantum random number generator or whatever, some other physical system, it doesn't matter. The assumption that goes in is about independence. No?
I agree. It doesn't matter. But this ability to think that there could be two variables that are statistically independent,
yeah,
was important. Of course, at the end, it was the choice of measurement, like setting in the experiment. But this is already a step that goes beyond like pure deterministic evolution, you know.
Okay, is there anyone from the panel who wants to comment on this still?
Because I'm thinking of winding up.
Sorry?
You're thinking of winding up?
Yeah, because we already...
I won't come.
No, I mean, if you want to, then you can, of course, do that. If you, as the devil, want to have the last word, then the devil wins. But no, otherwise, I would say we wrap up here. We already went half an hour above what we were planning to do. So thanks a lot for the panelists again for the discussions, and thanks all of you for participating here. Yeah, it was a great conference, and thanks again.
Thank you.